From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Sam Evans Brown, host of NHPR's Outside In for Laura Knoy, and this is The Exchange. Stay at home. Don't travel. Stay at least 6 feet away from people from outside your household. But you can still leave home for outdoor recreation.
We cannot stress this enough. You should stay at your house unless absolutely necessary. Of course, we'll not prevent you from leaving your home to go on a walk or when heading to the store or if you need groceries or simply going to work. But beyond essential necessities, you should not be leaving your home.
That's the slightly mixed message New Hampshire residents are getting from state officials at this time. As more people are finding themselves at home with more time on their hands and fewer officially sanctioned activities to engage in, the number of cars at trailheads and people on trails is ballooning. Packed trailheads at popular hiking spots like Mount Major and Mount Monadnock have led some New Hampshire residents to ask, should I really go for a hike right now? So today on the show, we're going to help you think about that question, but also talk about some simple, low-risk ways that you can get out, feel the sun on your face, but keep yourself safe at the same time. Joining us right now to talk about the science behind getting outside safely is Dr. Lisa V. Adams, a practicing physician and associate professor at the Infectious Disease and International Health section of the Department of Medicine at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. She's also the director of the global initiatives at Dartmouth and co-chair of Dartmouth's COVID-19 task force. Lisa, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you.
So maybe we should just start with the benefits of getting outdoors. What does it do for your immune system to get outside?
Sure. Well, we know that physical exercise is good for our mental and our physical health, right? That certainly that physical exercise and being outside can offer a very calming effect, especially after the endorphins are released. But really the usual recommendations of things like eating a diet high in fruits and vegetables, getting adequate sleep, 7 or 8 hours a night, and getting regular exercise are all things we can do to stay healthy overall. And we believe that, like all of our body systems, that this helps our immune system stay healthy as well. So certainly while you can, you should be getting outside and going for that solo walk or run.
So talk to us about what the current understanding of how the disease is transmitted, where things are at with that understanding. The recommendation we're getting is 6 feet of distance between you and anyone else. Tell us about why, where that recommendation comes from.
Sure. The magical 6 foot distancing recommendation that we're all now well aware of. Well, the good news is this is really based on science, including the best available science that we have about how COVID-19 is transmitted and what we know about the trajectory of respiratory droplets. So just like the flu, COVID-19 is spread person to person primarily via respiratory droplets, meaning that the virus is released in our respiratory secretions when an infected person coughs or sneezes or talks. Now that respiratory droplet can either make direct contact with another person's mucous membranes, their nose or mouth, or can land on a surface that someone then touches, who then touches their nose or eyes or mouth. So based on the size and weight, these respiratory droplets typically do not travel more than 6 feet before they settle. So that's where the 6 foot distancing guideline comes from. Now, I know that there has been at least one report suggesting that COVID-19 can linger in the air up to 3 hours in experimental conditions, meaning it becomes aerosolized and therefore could be transmitted that way. But the clinical relevance of this finding is still unclear. It certainly seems theoretically possible, but thankfully does not appear to be the main mechanism for transmission. Now, I do remind people that 6 foot distance guideline is a minimum distance. So feel free to give a wider berth when you are passing people that you don't live with. And of course, the best guidance is to stay home as much as possible.
If you have questions about being outdoors during a pandemic, send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. Or you can call, of course, 1-800-892-6444. 1-800-273-4777. I have to say, Lisa, I was speaking to some friends who live in New York City, and that finding that you were talking about how the particles in a laboratory condition can hang in the air for 3 hours, it has definitely permeated for folks who are in New York City. And there are many folks who are afraid of even going out onto the sidewalk down there.
Yes, and I think that can be dangerous. Again, we're talking about theoretical transmission here, and I think really we should be encouraging people to get outside, again, for their mental and physical health when they can. I know it can be difficult in crowded cities. I even found that in my normally quiet town, when I go for my walk, that there's many more people out walking and running and biking than I'm used to seeing, and have to, you know, we're all crossing the street or giving each other, a wide circle. I think it's best for us to be able to do this safely. I don't think we need to be as worried about passing people, and again, giving that 6 foot or more distance. Really, I think it's fair to say that we should feel comfortable being outside. We can say hello to our neighbors as we pass them from a 6 foot or more distance. But I do think getting outside, you know, for our own physical and mental health is going to be important. We don't know how long we're going to be in this state. We know we have a stay-at-home order at least until May 4th in New Hampshire. It may be extended. We don't know. And so we really have to be able to figure out how to pace ourselves mentally and physically to get through this period.
So one of the things that I have heard conflicting information about is sunshine. So does sunshine destroy the virus?
So we do know that ultraviolet light and irradiation can kill viruses, including coronaviruses. I don't expect that the ultraviolet light that we get on a sunny day to have much of an impact. We do know that this virus has spread now in all climates, tropical, temperate, and cold climates. But I think there's still much more that we're learning about this virus and how hardy it is exactly.
So, in other words, we don't know really for sure yet, so you can't count on sunshine to destroy the virus.
No, it may help, but I wouldn't rely on that as a major protective effect. I think being outside, too, where, again, there's much more air exchange, is probably the more important factor there.
So if there is something that means that there's inherently less risk of transmission outdoors, it's the fact that the air is mixing.
Yes, that's my sense, is that we have a much larger airspace that we're sharing when we're outside.
Right. On our show, Outside In, we're doing an episode about this today, and we spoke with a public health physician who said that one of the things that we've learned because of the HIV crisis is that messaging that strictly prohibits a desirable activity, in the case of HIV, sex, in the case of going outside, just feeling the sun on your face, has not been found to really work, that just telling people to not do things isn't really effective, and that what does work is suggesting ways to lower your risk. Does that jibe with your experience?
Oh, exactly. Again, I always say, as a physician, I wouldn't tell my patient to do something that I myself couldn't see myself doing, in terms of lifestyle changes and what have you. So we really have to make our guidance practical. And that's something in public health that we're always trying to do, is balance, limiting, or reducing risk, and making our guidance practical and reasonable for people to follow. Because I think you're right. Anything that's too stringent is just going to not be adhered to, and we've then lost the battle. So making our guidance realistic and practical, I think, is a very important part of public health.
So I'd like to see if we could maybe just run down a list of some activities that people may be thinking of doing, and we could talk about how you personally would make the calculus regarding these activities. And we alluded to one already, so running or cycling on your own seems like probably pretty safe, right?
That's my sense, too, and that's what I'm encouraging people to do, is to go for that solo run or walk or bike ride or hikes. Now, I know we're going to hear much more about trails and maybe finding the path less taken, but Narrow hiking trails, can be challenging for people to be able to give that 6 foot distance as you're passing one another. But in general, I'm encouraging the solo hikes, runs, walks, bike rides.
Which then leads to the question about what about driving somewhere to do something like hiking or, for instance, mountain biking?
Sure. You're driving in your own vehicle and parking at a trailhead and then getting outside. I don't think that increases the risk much. We know that we need to get into our car to perform other essential functions. If we or our household members whom we're already in close contact with are the ones in the car, I think that that's, generally considered, again, as safe as we can be.
What about things like golf or playing tennis where you're at a public facility? But, for tennis, obviously, social distance is kind of built into the game.
Exactly. And I have heard of people doing things like even trying to just, shoot baskets or play catch, and doing things like wiping down the basketball or the baseball or softball, or using, if you're playing tennis, using brand new tennis balls and even wiping down the net, of course, washing hands before and after. And all of that, probably reduces any risks. And again, making sure that you have that built-in 6 foot distance. Now, some experts are saying too that, in exercise, you actually want to consider even doubling the distance, to making it 12 feet, just because of breathing hard and what that may do to, increasing secretions being released and what we're breathing in. So I have heard that recommended. I also recommend playing those sports, tennis, catch, or golf, with your household members. So those people that you're already in close contact with. And again, just keeping in mind that this is all guidance. So I keep coming back to the more that you can limit contact with others and things outside of your home, the better.
Right. And as if we're thinking of this as activities that walk up the scale of risk, obviously getting in your car is slightly riskier than not. And going to a public facility where there are surfaces you might touch is slightly riskier than not as well.
Exactly. The other thing that I encourage too is, remember, since it is mud season, it's also not a bad time for thinking about indoor workouts, and many gyms and fitness centers are offering free online live or pre-recorded workouts and yoga classes. And for those things, you really don't need much more than a yoga mat, a towel, maybe sneakers to participate. So I'm encouraging folks to check those out as well.
What about swimming? Obviously, it's a little early for outdoor swimming, but what do we know about how the virus survives in water?
So my sense is certainly some secretions will be released from your mucous membranes, your nose and your mouth while swimming. But in a chlorinated pool, the virus is probably killed. We know that it is relatively easily killed with bleach and other common household disinfectants. But we also know that because of the potential contact getting in and out of the pool and dressing rooms and the various surfaces one might touch, I know that many indoor pools have closed. And when we get to a point where we can be swimming outdoors, we may be in a very different situation with the virus and the pandemic. Now, I don't know how much we know about the ability of the virus to survive in fresh water and in a large body of water. Obviously, I'd like to think that it would be quickly dispersed, but I think we'll expect to know more about just how safe swimming might be over time.
We have a call from David in Canterbury. David, you're on the exchange. What's your question for Dr. Adams?
Hey, I hate to ask questions like this, but I was talking with people lately, and this conversation came up. How long does this virus live in raw sewage and sludge? Every sewage plant in the United States is getting that virus coming in every day. And are they going to take that sludge and put it out on our farms and continue to spread the virus through the sludge they're putting on our farms?
For those who don't know, I believe David is referring to something called biosolids, which is a practice of taking processed sewage and using it as fertilizer on farm fields. What do we know about that?
this may be going beyond my expertise.
a hazard of a call-in show.
But again, you know, that's something I think that we'd have to get a sense of whether the virus is present in those materials. And I don't know if testing is being done. I will say, you know, we do know that from the virus being found on various surfaces, that we're talking about it being detected, you know, days after. What we don't know is whether the virus in those surfaces can actually lead to transmission. Is it dead virus or virus particles that actually couldn't infect another person? So that may be the case that with other materials that we might be using on our farms too, that if there is virus here, is it still viable virus or is it just virus particles? And if it's been a period of days since that sewage, you know, contained any virus, it may not survive. The virus may not be viable days later. So if we're talking about receiving these agricultural materials, you know, days or weeks after they've been sort of produced, I think that might be a more reassuring.
Alex writes us an email. We touched on this already, but maybe we should circle back to it. On an outdoor solo walk, what is the possibility of coming in contact with aerosols from someone who has passed by recently and who might have been talking on the phone, for instance?
Right. I think if you are passing through an airspace, you know, minutes or hours later, again, our sense is that the risk is quite low, that you would be contracting the virus in that way. It's again, it's all sort of a risk judgment here. But again, we don't think that there's very much transmission through aerosolized spread of the virus. So I want that to be reassuring to people that, you know, in general, that is not the main way that this virus is transmitted.
So if you're outdoors, the 6-foot rule is still a pretty good one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When being outdoors, the 6-foot rule still holds. And as I said, if you're exercising, you may even want to give a wider berth.
Philip writes in, says, I work for a small land trust, and one thing we're trying to promote is alternative parking areas and access points. Once you're on a trail, it's much easier to maintain safe distances. However, it's hard to get that information to people. We're working on trying out some better maps at our website, but who even knows to look there? My recommendation would be to call your local land trust if you want specific ideas. I'm curious, Lisa, what you personally have been doing in order to keep active and what your personal judgment of risk has been.
Again, I've been advocating for myself and others to get outside. And I've generally been going on walks and you know, sort of gentle hikes. And for me, it's really my job on the COVID-19 task force is almost 24/7. So I'm often reading emails or on the phone when I'm out walking. But I feel like just getting outside for a half hour, maybe even an hour, if I can spare it a day, is, I just feel that really helps us all recharge and is so important. So I think there's a reason why all of the stay-at-home orders, including the one issued by Governor Sununu, why these stay-at-home orders expressly allow leaving your home to exercise. Again, this I just can't say enough about the importance for our physical and mental health, and that we are going to need to pace ourselves through this time.
And one last question, Dr. Adams, which is that the CDC has been said to be reevaluating its guidance on wearing masks for healthy people while out in public. So your thoughts on the importance of masks, and do you think that we will wind up wearing masks more often when outdoors?
Sure. Well, masks are, and when and how to use them are obviously a hot topic right now. And I think that's mostly related to the concerns about right now about them being used in the general public, to concerns about there being asymptomatic spread. And, you know, unfortunately, we now have pretty convincing data that COVID-19 can be spread through pre-symptomatic transmission. There was a study published just yesterday by the CDC in which researchers in Singapore reviewed 157 patients with COVID-19 who had not traveled. So they were considered locally acquired cases. And they found 7 clusters of patients, 10 in total, where they felt that pre-symptomatic transmission had occurred, meaning that those patients were only exposed to another COVID-19 patient before that original patient had symptoms, about 1 to 3 days before the symptom onset. So we know that this can occur, but the good news is that it was a small percentage of patients. This only happens happened about 6% of cases in that particular study. So I think when we think about wearing masks, we are obviously going to prioritize who should be wearing a mask. And so I know some places are, and the guidance on this continues to evolve. I think we're looking at maybe having all healthcare workers wear a mask, even if they feel well, because of this asymptomatic spread risk.
Save those masks for the healthcare workers still.
That's my sense,
okay.
Especially if they're taking care of vulnerable patients. The other thing I will mention is that a bandana can work just as well in terms of preventing you from touching your face.
Right.
And so I think that's something we can think about. I don't think that masks for the general public are going to be a priority today or in the near future, but
okay.
Think of it. Bandanas can work just as well.
Thank you very much. That's Dr. Lisa Adams, a practicing physician and associate professor of infectious diseases at the International Health Section of the Department of Medicine at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. When we come back, some ideas about how you can get outside, get some exercise in anticipation of spring, even while keeping your distance from other people. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Sam Evans-Brown, and we will be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Sam Evans-Brown, host of NHPR's Outside In, filling in for Laura Kanoi. And today we're talking about how to get outside in the midst of a pandemic. Please reach out to us. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. We would like to know how you are getting out but staying solitary. One listener from Epsom, Alex, emailed saying, "I'm lucky enough to live within 25 minutes drive of 3 wonderful state parks." He later writes, "These parks are enormous and have plenty of room to maintain proper social separation between parties and lots of remote corners to visit. I encourage everyone to look up their local state parks and go exploring." On the other hand, Krista from Deerfield wrote saying, "Today on the Deerfield side of Pawtuckaway, there were 111 cars parked on a 3/4 of a mile stretch." She goes on to say, "Please help us get it out. Please help us get the state parks closed until this is all over. People are hiking in large groups, clustering at trailheads, and not practicing social distancing." Our next guests have some ideas about how you can stay safe and sane during this emergency. We're talking with Russell Hirschler, the executive director of the Upper Valley Trails Alliance and one of the lead partners in the Trail Finder Partnership. That's an organization that puts together the Trail Finder website. Hi, Russell.
Hello, Sam. How are you?
I'm great. And we're also talking to Lelia Mellon. She is the New Hampshire Projects Director for the National Park Service River Trails and Conservation Assistance Program. Lelia, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here.
So I'd like to start by asking you both individually how you are recommending that people get outside safely. And Lelia, I'll start with you.
Okay. So I'm telling people to follow the guidelines, as Dr. Adams said very nicely. Stay far apart from each other, 6 feet at least, and go in small groups. Like 10 or less people is really great. And also, as Dr. Adams said, maybe go with the people who you're already living with and in contact with. Go out, enjoy yourselves. Go out for walks, hikes, bikes. It is not the time to go do high-risk adventures. We don't need to send anybody to the emergency room with a broken bone or a sprained ankle or something. So it's really good to do things you're comfortable with and don't require anybody to come rescue you.
Russell, what about you?
I'm going to mirror pretty much what Lelia said and also what Dr. Adams said. Staying close to home is probably the best thing. We are generally saying try and stick to 10 miles from your home, and we'll be able to tell you some ways that you can find that information. And as Lilia said also, low risk stuff. This is not the time to get your last bunch of 4,000 footers in. Probably staying close to home is better.
So Lilia, can you explain what the Trail Finder website is?
Sure. So it's trailfinder.info, and it is a website that has curated trails. So that means that we've worked with the land managers and the landowners to have their get their permission to put these trails up on this website, where you can go find hundreds of trails around the state now that are close to your home. I mean, they're all over the place, but you can find a variety of trails, from very easy ones to high-impact ones, and variety of uses. It's not just walking. It's biking, mountain biking, et cetera. And there's all sorts of options for people to get out, as Russ said, close to your house.
So, Russell, I have two apps on my phone for finding trails. One is called All Trails, which I feel like is more often used by hikers and walkers. The other is called Trail Folks Forks, which is very popular among mountain bikers. How is Trail Finder different from those apps?
That's a great question, Sam. Trail Finder, as Lilia mentioned before, is all trail manager approved information. So everything you find on there, from the photos to the trailhead directions to the uses, are all approved by the trail manager themselves. All Trails is a great place to find basic trail information. Oftentimes, if you bring up a trail that's on Trail Finder and compare it to All Trails, you're going to find more comprehensive information about that trail network on the Trail Finder website. Again, because the trail manager has put all of that information up there in partnership with us. Trail Forks is a great place to get current trail conditions. Now, I want to mention that we are in mud season, so normally we would ask people to stay off the trails through typically Mother's Day. We are in extraordinary times here, and as we've been discussing, all of us are looking for ways to get outside. So as you're getting outside now, please be respectful of mud season, and use the normal precautions that you would if you were hiking on a muddy trail.
I'd like to just put out as a PSA, as someone who has looked at my own local trails on All Trails, occasionally there are trails marked there that are in fact private, but still show up on the app. So just a heads up there. Lilia, you specialize in water trails. I mean, it's still pretty chilly out there, but what's the thinking currently around exercise and boats, like kayaking or fishing?
Right. Well, in terms of the coronavirus, those activities are fine. You wouldn't want to congregate. You wouldn't want everybody fishing off of a bridge close to each other. But the trick right now is that it's really early spring. And so while you'll get the whitewater paddlers out, you want to be careful. The water is cold, and we don't need to be having that excess risk and necessitating search and rescue to have to come get you. So you can get out. The Connecticut River Paddlers Trail on their website put out a very nice piece. I think the Northern Forest Canoe Trail has done the same, talking about stay close to home, do short paddling trips. This is not the time for your epic adventure that's going to require you to go to multiple grocery stores and get things to stock up. You don't want to be going. Paddling often requires settling. And paddlers are usually very environmentally conscious and try to minimize how many cars are having to go back and forth up and down the river, and people pile into each other's cars. This is not the time to be doing that either. And then the other one, if you wanted to go on a multi-day adventure, the problem right now is the campsites mostly are not open yet. We've got the spring freshet coming down, so some might still be underwater even. And then other than that, the managers haven't been able to get out there and open them. So it would really be best to wait a bit, mostly for the weather to warm up, and then to paddle smartly, change our habits a bit so you're not going out on with big groups and not necessitating shuttles, things like that.
Remember, if you have questions about getting outdoors during the pandemic, we would like to hear them. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Michael writes in and says, I'm an educator, and several of my students have said they're under the impression that it's not safe to go outside to exercise, but I've been telling them that I believe it is and have been doing it every day. My question is, what advice do you have for educators to give to students to encourage them to go outside and stay physically active while still staying safe? Thoughts, Russell, about talking to kids about how they should get outside?
That's a great question. I actually have two young kids at home. And one of the things that's happening is a lot of their remote learning or distance learning that they're doing requires them to at least get outside, take pictures of nature, upload it to their classroom websites. That's one great way. Another is just if you have a family member, as we've been talking about, making sure that when you recreate, if you're going to recreate in more than one person, try and keep it with your own household. Take a short nature walk. I know that later in your show, you're going to be having something about backyard birding. Throw on a pair of binoculars, go outside and see what you can see in the spring migration. I'm actually standing in my bedroom looking out my back door, and I've seen about 9 different bird species just standing inside. So those are some ways I would recommend to get young folks outside.
Melissa in Merrimack writes, she says, I'm a runner. I find it very fortunate that I can get outside and run. I also have very little, a very small... I'm not quite sure how this is. I have an open area near me where I can walk outside, thankfully. However, there are definitely trails that are way too crowded, and it's scary right now to have trails that are that crowded. I wonder how you suggest that folks balance this. Obviously, they can go online, they can find trails and explore trails that they've never been on at all. But I can imagine that for local folks, an influx of people from other towns coming to their quiet local spot can be scary.
Yeah. So I want to mention that Trail Finder has almost 650 trail networks across Vermont and New Hampshire. And there's also a companion website in Maine. So for any listeners who are listening from Maine, you can go to mainetrailfinder.com and find information about local trails there. I think everyone who heads out to go recreate on a local trail needs to have a plan B and a plan C. So if you're going to your favorite trailhead and you see that there's people standing at the trailhead, perhaps talking, perhaps not adhering to the social distancing rule, or the trailhead is just packed with cars, go to plan B. And then if you go to that one and you see the same thing, go to plan C. Almost every one of our towns in New Hampshire has conservation lands, has municipal lands that are open for recreation. A lot of those are on our Trail Finder website, so I would encourage folks to check that out. And if in your town you don't see trails on trailfinder.info, check your town website and see what local trails there may be in your own community that you haven't gone to yet.
Lelia, I'm curious how you think about this. How many cars at a trailhead would you find to be too many for your own personal risk calculus?
Well, it's an interesting question. So it depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about a single track trail where you're going to be running into people, it's going to be different than if you're on a trail network that really is actually old logging roads or something, because there you could get away from folks. The other thing to maybe consider is, because I'm guilty of this, of going out with people that we are driving, so it's actually people who are in their same social network, but they've driven separately, so there might be less people than you think, if that makes sense. Just because everybody's driven separately, but they are actually a family, so that it's a one group. Having heard, though, that somebody just had 110 cars or something you said earlier from an email,
yeah,
that's a bit crazy.
Right.
So just we just need to all be smart. And I know before this experience, there, as Russ said, there's so many small trail networks that usually aren't discovered and known, except for the people who really are local. And that's a beautiful thing that most of us love, having these trails in our backyards, in our towns. And so I would hope that if you can find those gems that other people don't necessarily know about.
I'm wondering if part of this, too, is developing a new set of norms for what you do when you encounter another group on a trail, that maybe folks should just be extra conscientious about making sure there's plenty of space for passing. Have either of you noticed those types of norms started sort of developing organically out there?
Russell, I certainly
have. Go ahead, Lila. Why don't you take that?
Yeah, sorry. I definitely have. And I have to say, sort of because it's mud season, I have not been going on the single-track trails. I've been more on the old roads, you know, classics roads or something even. And people are kind of staying to either side of it, passing, saying hello politely, and just moving on.
Russell, you were going to say something?
Oh, I've noticed the same thing on any kind of trails that I've hiked on. But I'm also noticing it on the road when people are running or cycling on their own streets. They're stopping, they're chatting, but they're being 6 to 12 feet away from each other across the street. So I definitely think it's happening organically as we're moving through this.
I've certainly noticed that when two groups pass each other, there's a tendency for one to step fairly far off the trail to allow another to go by if the trail is fairly narrow. So Tim from Mont Vernon is on the line. Tim, do you have a question for or a comment to say here on the air?
I'm kind of gonna. Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I'm kind of going to reiterate what was said earlier. Mont Vernon is a little tiny town, and we have a place right next door in Lineboro, a trailhead, where there were like 75 cars there last weekend. And it was, you know, went viral, the photographs of the road, and the cops had to come, and people's driveways were blocked in, and it was just insane. Yet 1 mile away, there's a Mont Vernon Conservation Commission trailhead, and there was one vehicle there accessing 3 miles of trails. So what I want to say to your audience is what's been said before. Maybe stay away from the place at Purgatory Falls with the 75 cars is well documented. It's on all the trail seeking apps and stuff like that. Whereas what I would recommend is that people either within their own town or a town they feel like visiting, they go to the town website, like somebody just said, and go to the Conservation Commission. It's usually the Conservation Commission that maintains any trails on town-owned property. And you can find some wonderful trails just in Mont Vernon alone, which is a tiny little town of less than 2,000 people. And we have miles and miles of trails. And I don't want you all rushing up here from Massachusetts, but we have plenty of room.
Well,
the ones that everybody's going to looking on their phone are safe.
Unclear how many Massachusetts people are listening, but a PSA that they too should have a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C. Trixie from Londonderry is on the line. Trixie, what's your question or comment?
Well, my question is this. We're talking about recreation today, and I'm a horse owner, and exercising horses, as a state veterinarian has said, is important to the motility of the horse's stomach. And there are some areas like sticking within the 10-mile guideline, is it something that seeing a horseback rider out on the trail, is that acceptable? Is it something that people can consider doing, we horse owners can consider doing?
Russell, Lilia, I wonder if you have any thoughts about that, about how obviously life is more complicated if you're a horse owner. Any thoughts from either of you?
I'm happy to jump in on that first. The first thing I would say is, again, this is mud season, so if you're taking your horses out in the woods, just be aware of that, because horses during mud season can create a lot of damage. We're open to all recreational uses. Horse and equestrian riders have a different set of issues that they're dealing with. Their trails are usually different. They need larger trailhead parking areas so that they can turn their horse trailers around, so that will be somewhat limiting as well. But there is a general trail etiquette for equestrian users and how they interact with mountain bikers and hikers. So that information is actually on our website at uvtrails.org, which is one of the partner organizations for TrailFinder. So I would encourage anyone who is curious about how to recreate with equestrian riders to check out that etiquette document that we have on our website. And yes, I would say equestrian riders, when you can, get outside. Again, be aware of social distancing. And like I said, there's only a certain number of places where equestrian riders can get their trailers to turn around.
Right.
So we have this,
Russell,
growing...
unfortunately, I think we've got to let you go. Russell, Lelia, thanks so much for being with us. Russell Hirschler is the executive director of the Upper Valley Trails Alliance, and Lelia Mellon is the projects director for the National Park Service River Trails and Conservation Assistance Program here in New Hampshire. Coming up after a break, we're going to talk about a activity that it can be very low risk indeed, backyard burning, birding. Send your questions to exchange@nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Sam Evans Brown, host of NHPR's Outside In, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, join us for America Amplified, a call-in special from the New England News Collaborative. Healthcare workers in New England are facing incredible challenges on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic, from long hours and dangerous conditions to shifting public policies. On this special, hosted by Laura Kanoy, we'll bring together voices from around the region on this issue. That's tomorrow, live at 9 on NHPR. But today, getting outside safely, ways that you can be in nature but stay close to home. Call us with your ideas, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR.org. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org. You, of course, can work on your garden. You might have a window box or a planter. There's plenty of things that you can do in your backyard to work on social distancing. But have you considered backyard bird watching? We're speaking now with Eric Masterson, who, when not fielding questions about birds, has been bicycling the migration route of the broad-winged hawk from New Hampshire to Panama a couple of years ago. Eric coordinates the land protection and stewardship activities at the Harris Center for Conservation in Hancock. Eric, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for doing this program. It's a really important topic.
So Eric, how has the Harris Center adapted to this new age? Do you have materials that you'd recommend that folks trying to learn to appreciate the nature in their backyard might avail themselves of?
Well, it's a challenge for all organizations like the Harris Center. We're geared towards working outside, and so to transition all of that material online in the space of a couple of weeks is an immense challenge. But we are doing a couple of things. I'll speak a little bit about bird migration, because one of the great ironies of the moment is that while we're all being asked to restrict our movement to, you know, we can measure it in feet, meters, miles, but we're told not to move. At the same time, one of the greatest mass migrations the world has ever known is happening, and it's just a remarkable phenomenon. Of course, I'm talking about bird migration, and there's a tendency when we think of that to think it's happening at someone else's, you know, at a refuge or in another country or someone else's fantastic backyard. But it's happening everywhere, right over, you know, each and every one of our houses. And I can tell you this because I've been studying backyard nocturnal migration from my backyard for the last 5 years, and I literally have to walk 5 steps out onto my deck, and I set up a recorder and I record the call notes of the birds that are migrating overhead. And I'm charting this on a blog at the Harris Center. Just go to the harriscenter.org, and there's a tab there, other things to do, and you can see some of the other activities that we're trying to get online for folks to do. But that's one that I'm particularly excited about, because right now we're at the very early stages of migration, and in late April and May it's really going to kick off, and so now is a fantastic time to get involved with it, because you don't get swamped in May. There'll be, you know, 40, 50, 60 new birds singing, and it can be very confusing to get involved in May. But if you start out now, just as the birds trickle in, sapsuckers will be coming back in about a week. Some of the sparrows are starting to arrive now. Barn swallows will be arriving mid-April. And then towards the end of April, a lot more neotropical migrants. And so now is a terrific time to learn birdsong while there isn't so many birds singing. And it's a wonderful time to get out and experience that phenomenon.
So, Eric, I know this isn't your personal area of expertise, but there's another migration that at least has kicked off here in southern New Hampshire, which is that amphibians are on the move. Can you tell us briefly about Big Night?
Yeah, well, Brett Talen at the Harris Center is the person who coordinates that. I can tell you that we're very concerned that we don't want to be sending people out a program to safely cross amphibians on roads during big migration nights. And we really have shut that down this year because we don't want people going out without training because it's, you know, you're on busy roads. And secondly, we don't want to encourage people to be gathering in groups because if you have a really cool salamander, everyone gathers around to look at it. And it's just not good practice at the moment. So we're not encouraging that. But yes, salamander migration will be happening through the month on, you know, warm days over 40 degrees with wet, you know, warm wet nights where the temperature is over 40 degrees.
And I would just say personally, if you're looking for something to do with kids, heading out to the nearest vernal pool, walking out your backyard and checking out some frog egg masses is not a bad way to go. But Eric,
yeah.
Back to bird watching. We got an email from James who says, I'm writing about backyard birding. I love birds and I'm terrible at identifying them. I want to get better and I don't have a good field guide. Can you recommend an online resource and maybe a physical field guide too for the next time I can get to a bookstore?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of them out there. My personal favorite would be the Sibley Guide, and you can get that as an app also. And so as an app, it has the advantage of having bird sound, which you can't obviously reproduce in a paper field guide. So that's a good field guide. The Peterson Field Guide is also excellent. The Stokes Field Guide, there's quite a number of them out there. I recommend now in terms of easing the burden on yourself, because I find this with other things, you know, with astronomy, which is not a strong suit of mine, even wildflowers, it can be daunting. And so to get, if someone could point me to a field where there were only a few wildflowers, that would be a really attractive proposition for me learning wildflowers, because, you know, I wouldn't be deluged by options. And so similarly, now is a really great time to start. Right now, the only songsters now, purple finch, brown creeper, winter wren, there's a few birds singing now. In a month's time, it's going to be a much more difficult proposition. So learn those birds now. And so when May comes around, you'll be an expert on those ones.
I'm curious if you have kids and are thinking that birding might be a good way to get them out of the house, inject some novelty into their life, apart from just handing them a pair of binoculars and pushing them out the door, how do you recommend getting kids involved in this activity?
So a bird feeder is a fantastic way to go. Because one of the challenges for kids will be to, you know, kids will have difficulty using binoculars. And so one of the challenges with bird watching is that very often they're hard to see. They can be obtrusive. They can be, unobtrusive and buried in a marsh or distant. And so that's a challenge. So bringing them close helps to engage kids. So a bird feeder is a terrific way to do that. Building bird houses is a great way to get kids interacting with birds and their ecology and their habitat needs. And so there's a whole suite of birds that you can attract to nest in your yard, depending on what sort of habitat you have. But you can put up a simple shelf under a soffit for phoebes or for robins. You can build a cavity birdhouse like for chickadees or bluebirds. Even barred owls, wood ducks, if you've got a marsh nearby. There's a whole lot you can do. And now is a great time to be putting up birdhouses.
I'm curious, when it comes to setting up a bird feeder, are there sort of best practices when it comes to both your viewing pleasure, but also the health and safety of birds?
Yes, absolutely. So you want to be very cognizant of the opportunity for birds to fly into windows. Window strikes are one of the great killers of birds. So place it in a Windows that are particularly problematic are ones where a bird can see right through the house, or reflective windows that reflect back the outside. So a window that if you stand outside your house and look at a window and you find that you're looking at the forest because you see a reflection of a forest, then that's the sort of window that a bird is going to have problems with. So keep away from windows like that. Be aware that we're in bear season now, so take the feeders in. I'm probably going to be getting myself into trouble with Fish and Game now, because Fish and Game probably have an advisory not to be feeding birds right now, but these are extraordinary times. So definitely, if you have bear issues, don't feed the birds. If there are bears in your area and they're problematic, because you're going to be getting the bears into trouble, and no one wants to do that. No one wants to create a problem bear. So take the bird feeders in at night, and if you do have bearish issues, cease feeding until that ceases to be an issue.
So perhaps start with the backyard birds. Then, as if this wears on, we can progress to a bird feeder. And I will say, I was out in the woods not too long ago and was seeing actually a lot of bear tracks. So indeed, they are up and about.
They are. Oh no, they're definitely out. There are several reports of them out already. So I encourage everyone to be very cognizant of that. Yeah.
So I'm curious, Eric, you personally have a lot of interesting projects going on in your bird life. Can you just tell us about what you've got that you're finding interesting in this time of hanging out at home?
Yeah, I'm really into the nocturnal migration. So that's a huge passion of mine. And I run a blog at the Harris Center. So just Google Harris Center bird migration. It'll take you straight to it. You know, the broad-winged hawk project you mentioned, that had led me into a hang gliding life, which is on hold now. I know everyone's being very careful not to burden the healthcare system. And so I don't think dangerous sports are a wise choice right now. But I'd say right now the thing that's most exciting for me is this nocturnal bird migration study that I'm doing.
Karen from Plainfield is on the line. Karen from Plainfield is not on the line. We just lost her. Eric, I'm curious for spring migration. Are there certain trends that you're noticing that folks who are either just getting into birding or have been doing it for a while should have their eye on? What in particular have you been seeing?
Well, I mean, there's lots of trends. I mean, the most obvious one I just posted this morning about, I'm kind of trying to avoid the news because it's so depressing, and I've had enough of coronavirus graphs. And so a real trend that we're going to be seeing now is the increasing biodiversity of birds. And so there's a bell curve of migration, and we're at the left-hand side of the, you know, we're just starting out on it. And in mid-May, it's going to peak. And so that's a trend of increasing abundance, and that's a wonderful thing. And I'll be charting the progress of that. There's, you know, some birds are becoming more abundant. It's not all a bad news story, but some birds are definitely becoming less abundant. Birds that breed in grassland. And so if you have a large expanse of grassland that you manage, 10 acres, 20 acres, that's something to be aware of. In terms of how you manage it, it will have real-world consequences for birds like bobolinks and eastern meadowlarks, grasshopper sparrows, things like that. Cavity nesters, if you have a very clean forest that you take down all the snags, then you're going to have less cavities for things like bluebirds and barred owls and great crested flycatchers. And so that's where you can help ideally don't be cleaning your forest. A messy forest is better for birds, but then birdhouses will help too. And also, if I could ask folks to redefine the concept of a perfect lawn, I think for so often we've considered the perfect lawn to be a green expanse with no weeds. And I would argue that the perfect lawn is a messy, weedy lawn with no pesticides. And the great arbiters of a perfect lawn are birds. If you have lots of birds on your lawn, no matter what it looks like, you have the perfect lawn. If you have a green sward with no weeds, I'm pretty sure you don't have many birds on it too. So redefine what you think of as perfection.
Eric, if folks are, you mentioned we're on the left side of the bell curve. So if folks are looking to track the birds as they come through, what are the species that are here now and what will be coming through soon?
So tree swallows are an early migrant. So we've already, our tree swallows are already back. And they don't all come on the same day. So they, you know, come over several weeks. So the earliest tree swallows are back. Phoebes, the earliest phoebes are back. like I said, within the next week to 10 days, our sapsuckers will be coming back. Many of our sparrows are starting to come back now. They don't rely on insects to the same degree that other neotropical migrants do, and so they can subsist on some of the seeds that are left over. Barn swallows will be here mid-month. Towards the end of the month, the thrushes will be coming back, the first warblers. And so it's really a fascinating thing. You know, what a time to be stuck at home. I wish we weren't, but if you were to be stuck at home and wanting to learn about the wonderful world of birds and bird migration, this is just a perfect time to be doing it.
So that's your public service announcement, folks. You do not have to go far to appreciate nature. I want to thank our guests for being on the program today. Of course, those who we've already said goodbye to, but Eric Masterson is with us from the Harris Center for Conservation and the author of the blog, A Kettle of One and Night Songs. Eric, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Sam. Take care.
If you'd like to hear more about this, I would recommend our show, Outside In. You can download it wherever you get your podcasts. We've got a whole episode centered on this question coming out today. The Exchange's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our regular theme music is composed by Bob Lord. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Remember, the conversation continues online. Our Facebook page is NHPR Exchange and at nhpr.org. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Thanks so much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.